Jesse Felder, founder, editor, and publisher of thefelderreport.com. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, good to see you, Tom. Thanks for having me back.
Absolutely. It's always a pleasure, Jesse. And, you know, you look very, very widely and broadly at the investing landscape. And it seems like this is actually a very interesting time, right? There's so many different pushes and pulls within the markets. You know, looking at rates, how that affects the investing landscape, how the Fed's new mandate and communication, let's say allowance, is going to affect things. But I want to start off by talking a little bit about basically your view on the Iran war and how that has really, let's say, highlighted the difference between the physical and paper markets in the oil industry.
Yeah. You know, it's just fascinating to watch. I just wrote about this in my market comment over the weekend. You know, what would it take? This isn't a riddle, I guess. This is more of just kind of a rhetorical question. What would it take to see oil inventories fall to their lowest levels in 40 plus years and investors turn more bearish on the oil price than ever before in history? Because that is the situation we're in right now. Literally near record low, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve hasn't been this low. It's the fastest 3-month depletion of the SPR that we've seen. And total inventories, including the SPR, are literally lower than they've been in 40 years. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, demand is still, you know, setting new kind of record highs. And so you have the most bullish supply demand backdrop for oil that you could possibly imagine. And Goldman Sachs tells us institutional investors have never been more bearish in terms of sentiment on the oil price than they are today. You see that in, you know, Brent futures. The USO oil ETF has a record, you know, short interest in the ETF. So it's just fascinating to me, this dichotomy between super bullish fundamentals and super bearish sentiment. It's the type of setup I think you look for as an investor to see, for contrarian opportunity. The Iran war, the answer to that question, twofold. It's one, it's the war, which creates this really, really bullish kind of supply crunch. And then investors thinking, okay, the strait's going to reopen. There's a peace deal, right? And they all turn bearish on oil. But at the same time, I think there's another dynamic that's just as important, which is this AI trade, right? Mm-hmm. Everything in the markets is AI. It's actually more extreme. Rushir Sharma just wrote about this in the Financial Times today. It's more extreme and more concentrated in AI in the markets than it was in kind of .com 26 years ago. In other words, more of the stock market performance and stuff is dependent upon a smaller group of stocks that are at the center of the AI mania than the .com was, 26 years ago. So if it's not AI, nobody wants to own it, right? I think it's also fascinating that look at a 5-year look back. The two sectors that have performed the best within the S&P 500 are tech and energy, and they're essentially neck and neck over a 5-year look back. People love tech and they hate energy, and it's just amazing to me with a terrific 5-year run for energy that investors still are so bearish. And to me, it's just such a bullish, contrarian sign that that these things are undervalued. I just make one final point that when you look at the gold price, I mean, we've probably talked about this before, Tom, that the gold price is a really good leading indicator of the broader commodity space, of oil prices, of interest rates. And so the run that we saw in gold, with that 2000 point run or whatever, up to 5,500, leads the broader commodity space by about 18 months to 2 years. And so this move in commodities that we've seen higher is really kind of probably in its middle innings, and still has another 6 to 12 months to run to kind of catch up with the gold price. And so that tells me that this this longer term breakout in oil is just the start of a bigger move, not the end of a move, as most investors, I think, today look at it as this is the end of the move. Well, no. You know, and we can talk about all the dynamics that have to, you know, that will drive oil prices higher. But I mean, the most basic thing is all the strategic reserves are empty now. So like, not only is the regular amount of demand there, normal demand there, but now all these reserves have to be refilled. And not only that, so many countries are going to want to build even bigger reserves to protect against these types of things in the future. So that demand is even going to be stronger at the time when supply is going to be remain constricted for a time. So all in all, it's a very, very bullish setup for energy. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's actually, you know, where I wanted to kind of continue on is the idea of needing to refill the SPR. And let's say the strategic, ironically, the strategic importance of having enough of a padding or an inventory to be able to absorb future shocks like this. Obviously, you know, the SPR was emptied at a historic rate in order to be able to combat these higher prices and keep the world functioning. But now the ability to dampen anything, any future event or shock like that has been greatly removed. So, not only is it, you know, looking retrospectively of needing to refill, but I think your point about countries wanting more of a pad, more of a, or a bigger SPR, let's say, is quite important and important to consider as well going forward.
Yeah, I mean, that's a boost to demand. We've seen that you look at the demand figures, implied demand is kind of what they report. And it's sitting at or hitting record highs consistently. You know, this refilling of strategic reserves is going to represent incremental demand on top of that. And then adding on to those, right, saying, okay, we want even bigger strategic reserves for these countries that are most affected, you know, in Asia and stuff, and places are going to say, like, we need even bigger reserves than that. But there's another dynamic too, and that's playing out really since the new administration took over, and that's, you know, they removed a lot of incentives for transitioning to EVs. And so EV sales have dramatically disappointed over the last couple of years. They were saying that, you know, by 2030, a couple of years ago, it was estimated that 50% of US car sales would be EVs. Well, that dropped to 25%.
There were specific government mandates stating that they wanted that as well, yeah. Like in California, I believe, right?
Yeah. And so then last year that dropped to, oh, maybe it's only going to be about 25-28% of car sales by 2030. Now that's down in the teens, mm-hmm. are going to be EVs. You know, the demand, and just because the, you know, government incentives and stuff aren't there. So you take that equation, right? And okay, what does that mean? That means there's going to be more demand for fossil fuel combustion engine vehicles than anticipated, right? So, you know, all of this, the demand dynamics are very, very strong, and supplies are still hampered. I mean, all of this too that we're talking about assumes the Strait just opens and goes back to whatever 80-90% of its normal flows pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't, you know, and nobody's kind of, you know, factoring this in, you know, it's fascinating to see Friday on the markets close, right? You know, the hostilities kind of ramp up again, right, over there. And, you know, we're attacking Iran and doing this stuff, and then Iran attacks back, whatever. And then Sunday night, right before the, you know, futures open again, peace talks are back on. We're going to end the hostilities. And, you know, and so there's clearly an appreciation for how this affects markets. And I do think there's been a very clear attempt to manipulate oil prices lower. I'm not, you know, talking about a conspiracy theories here or anything, but China has imported dramatically less oil over the last 3 months than they had in the months prior. I mean, it's they've cut imports dramatically. A lot of those because a lot of their imports came from Iran. So if they can't, you know, if we block the Iran's ability to use the Strait as part of these negotiating dynamics, China can't import. But at the same time, you know, we've emptied the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and exported more oil than we've ever done before, too. So there's been a huge coordinated global effort to suppress the oil price. And that works for a time, right? You can, I mean, obviously it's worked amazingly well, from oil price from 120 or something back down to 70. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's only, you know, we're literally hitting the bottom of strategic reserves now at the same time that, you know, we're going to have to start, getting back to kind of a more normalized market. And so the fundamentals will, you know, as Shakespeare put it, the truth will out, and the truth in the oil markets will soon be revealed over the next several months. And it's going to be much higher oil prices. I estimate, if you just look at the relationship between inventories and oil prices, mm-hmm. the oil prices is at least $50 below where it would trade on normal supply demand dynamics right now. So $50 higher, you're talking $120 oil price is probably the natural price where it should be settling right now, if not for all of the other stuff that's going on. As I said, China reducing imports, the U.S. dramatically expanding exports through strategic reserve releases. So, you know, I think we're probably headed back to that $120 oil price. You see this in the insider activity at, you know, corporate insiders, especially in Canadian energy companies, but you see it in U.S. Energy companies too, where insiders are buying hand over fist, because I don't think they have any confidence that these lower oil prices are sustainable. Mm-hmm. You see it in commercial hedgers and the commitment to traders report too. There's no hedging going on right now, right? A lot of these companies, if they believed that, and there hadn't been over the last few months, I think if these oil companies believed that oil prices were going to come back down and stay down, they would have been hedging the heck out of it over the last couple of months. There was almost no hedging done. So they know that, okay, you can suppress the oil price for a short period of time, but over the long run, the fundamentals are going to assert themselves. And that's mm-hmm. going to mean a higher oil price sustainably for number of years, probably.
Well, that's a really interesting point about the idea of insiders, you know, buying a lot of their own, stock. But Jesse, looking out, and again, trying to consider not only typical demand to fuel the world, but also refilling SPRs or inventories, domestic inventories all around the world. Do you think that, or how do you think that this starts to affect OPEC? Obviously, you know, we've seen some turbulence in OPEC itself, of countries wanting to leave because they want to produce more oil. I think it's also an interesting point that I think Doomberg actually made, saying that China, for example, typically has a lot more oil, and this is a bit more of an opaque market than people tend to think that it is, you know, considering that they probably had a lot more inventories than people expected. But again, going forward for OPEC specifically, does this mean maybe higher production targets for them? Or if they don't want to play ball for some of these countries, is that more of a nail in the coffin for OPEC itself?
Yeah, I think the bigger question is, you know, I obviously don't even know what, you know, OPEC seems like it's, you know, coming under stress with its ability to kind of keep its members in line and even want to be a part of the overall consortium. But I think the bigger issue here is that OPEC hasn't been really the marginal supplier of oil for a number of years, really for the last 20 years, I'd say, with the advent of fracking. Right, the U.S. became the largest oil producer in the world, and all of that money in the wake of the financial crisis, all of that, you know, 0% interest rate, easy money loans went into the energy industry, and they massively turned the U.S. back. You know, we became energy independent again, and the largest, you know, producer. But that huge boom in oil supply, right? That happened really from 2005 to 2015 when the oil price 14-15 oil price crashed. You know, it was really the main driver of the lower trend in the oil price from whatever it was, I think it's 2008 peak down to 2014 low, actually going negative in 2020, was because so much new supply came on, right? And it really comes back to the capital cycle, right? Where's the most money in the economy flowing? And back then in 2005, 6, 7, 8, 10, it was flowing into the energy sector. They invested that in massive new supplies through fracking, which created a price crash. Really, since oil price crash 2014-15, we had new ESG mandates for a lot of investors and boards and stuff. This sector for the last 10 years has been starved of capital, right? And now it's AI. Nobody wants to invest in energy because of, you know, the AI. Was ESG before, but because there's been no investment in exploration and production for 10 years, at the same time as demand has been growing, setting new record highs for oil-based products, you know, that is what sets up a new super cycle for the oil price, and it's true of the commodity space more broadly, is this idea of the capital cycle. And you look at, you know, Gehring and Rosenzweig have done really good work on this, and they show that it's these supply cycles that drive bull and bear markets in oil. You know, whether it's a huge new find coming on in the North Sea or whatever, it's these big finds that come on market and then create an oversupply that is sustained for a number of years. But it's when those new supplies come on market and then start to peak out and go into decline that you get this new super cycle. And that's exactly what's happening with the shales here in the United States. Growth is gone, right? I think the Permian is the only basin that has actually seen any growth in the last couple of years, and it's potentially peaking out. And yeah, as I said, GNR have done good work on this, where all of these producers in the shale industry, because of this oil price crash, have had to high grade all their wells. They drilled all the best, most attractive wells first, right? So now the oil that's remaining that is yet to frack is the most difficult to actually pull out of the ground. And, you know, so it's not as easy to actually maintain the growth that they've seen at all, or to bring on new supplies. And then we're seeing this, right? We're seeing a couple of big spikes in oil prices over the last, you know, five, whatever years, with the war in Ukraine creating an oil price spike. Now this war in Iran creating another spike. And this, there hasn't really been much of a supply response by frackers. And that's because the just available supply is not there. The investment hasn't been there. And so I think this capital cycle is, to me, the most important dynamic, you know, way more important than OPEC or even the Iran war or anything. It's just the fact that there's been no exploration and production investment for such a period of a time, that to get sustainably low oil prices from here on, you're going to need another major find, another major technology breakthrough. It's not saying it's not possible. It's just saying that right now we're at a position where supplies are really restricted and demand continues to hit record highs. And until you actually get a bunch of capital coming into the energy sector again and investing in new technologies like some new breakthrough like fracking, or, you know, find some big new find somewhere, you know, the trend for oil prices is going to be to the upside.
So Jesse, is there a particular, let's say, sector of the energy space that this supply shortfall and underinvestment in exploration, is there a particular part of the energy infrastructure landscape that is most attractive to you in that case?
Excuse me. Yeah, it's kind of those, you know, there's the top tier companies, the Exxons, Chevrons. Those have never really been super interesting to me. I mean, they're terrific long-term investments. I mean, because they're integrated and have refining operations and, you know, transportation stuff. I mean, they're, you know, broadly diversified, but they're generally more highly valued than the pure exploration and production companies. To me, the E&P companies are the most compelling because they have the greatest leverage to the oil price. And they tend to be more undervalued at lows, which is where I think we are today, because of that leverage. And so I think that, you know, there's a reason why it's something I've written about over the past couple of years, I've seen a lot of these super successful, billionaire investors kind of get into this space, right? The S&P has a 2.5%, less than 3% exposure to energy. Berkshire Hathaway has Occidental Petroleum as a fairly large position. I think they're probably, that position alone makes them three times overweight energy. Mm-hmm. But you have, Paul Singer getting involved with, I think, in Phillips Petroleum. And obviously, energy executives, Jerry Jones from the Dallas Cowboys, was investing heavily into Comstock, buying shares in the open market, natural gas producer in the U.S. That stock's done really well. So I think that it's more interesting to look at these E&P companies because of their leverage to the oil price, because of what's going on in terms of the insider buying there. Last year, there was an opportunity it was fascinating, around the Liberation Day kind of sell-off. The bearishness was really kind of centered around the kind of deep water drilling companies. And there was a real interesting opportunity there with lots of insider buying. Those stocks have done really, a lot better since then. And so I think it's really kind of the drillers themselves, the oil producers, where I think the opportunity is today.
So Jesse, as a, kind of a contrast to the energy market, but in the same vein that you're explaining this through an underinvestment in exploration and production is the precious metals industry. Obviously, we've seen a pretty substantial pullback from the highs, but as you said earlier, gold seems to really lead a lot of the commodity complex. Do you think that we've seen enough of a pullback to make gold attractive again?
I do. I think, there were a couple sentiment, not just sentiment, but fundamental things that I was looking at with gold that I'm sure we talked about last couple times we talked, Tom, about how it looked like gold was in need of a correction to kind of work off some of the speculative froth that it had attracted. And at the same time, with the monetary cycle is one of the, maybe the key thing for the trend in the gold price. And so when you have a central bank looking to cut interest rates, very bullish, gold usually anticipates that. Mm-hmm. And then when you have central bank kind of pivoting back towards towards rate hikes, gold's going to anticipate that, and it's going to lead to some weakness in the gold price. And so this is exactly what we've seen, right? The markets this year were pricing in three interest rate cuts. And so, in anticipation of that, gold ran to 5,500 an ounce or something. And then it turns out, okay, rate cuts aren't coming. Now we're likely getting hikes. And so gold price reacts. So gold price has actually come back a lot closer to what kind of a model based on real interest rates is suggesting it should be at. I mean, the real interest rates have essentially, and you could look at basically TIPS yields, are kind of flat year over year. That suggests gold price should be flat-ish year over year. We're getting kind of back close to that levels. I think we're back to kind of October last year. So we're getting close. I think for really what you want to see to get bullish on gold, for me to get excited about it is the prospect of real interest rates coming back down again. And so if you were to get some real weakness in the economy, a bursting of the dot-com bubble, those types of things that would really take some pressure off the Fed in terms of inflation, then you'd probably see real interest rates come down. That would be a very bullish dynamic for gold. Gold would start to anticipate that. So I think we're kind of getting maybe close to that. And in terms of the gold sentiment, the flows into ETFs were just so huge, early this year. But those have completely reversed. We've seen, 12-month flows, coming out of gold, just like energy, Nobody wants to own gold right now when AI has, when semiconductor stocks and these memory stocks are doing what they're doing. It's like, we need to put everything into Micron and SanDisk and whatnot. And so pull it out of gold, pull it out of Bitcoin, pull it out of whatever else you own and go all into these things. The silver to gold ratio was another one where the silver price exploded relative to gold. That to me is always a sign that speculative juices are flowing to a degree that's usually unhealthy in the short run. But we've seen silver price come way back down too. So that ratio is starting to kind of normalize. We're getting some signs that this correction, I was looking for a correction to come back to 4,000. I thought if gold came back to 4,000, that would be a good kind of round level, support level buying opportunity. We're there. We're a little quicker than I thought we'd be. The other thing about getting back to 4,000 is it kind of put it right in line with the corrections. Look back at that bull market from 2000 to 2011 and gold, and the typical correction kind of came down about that much. It would be equal about 1,500 points in the gold price here. So we're about even with kind of the typical bull market correction you'd see in the gold price. So yeah, I'm starting to kind of look at gold as interesting again, just because of where we are in that monetary cycle, where we are in terms of the sentiment cycle, it's starting to look interesting. Mm-hmm.
Well, as a function of, as you said, the monetary cycle here, Jesse, how do you think the, you know, Warsh's first Fed meeting and this idea of less communication is going to affect, basically real rates and long-term rates going forward here, yeah, in combination with this, you know, supposed energy spike that we had? Does this kind of create more inflation, or is the fact that he was very clear about inflation being one of their major focuses for this next, let's say, Fed era, is that something that you're looking at very closely? Is this either inflationary / maybe stagflationary environment?
Yeah. I think it's absolutely, it's one of the most important dynamics to pay attention to right now. I think, I don't know how many people remember, but when Jay Powell took over the Fed in 2018, he came out hawkish. Right. His first couple of Fed meetings, I don't remember which one it was, but it was in mid 2018, maybe summer of 2018. He's, you know, I think Fed funds rate was at 2%. And he said at a press conference, we're nowhere near neutral. Right.
Right.
That kind of people interpreted that to mean they need to go from 2 to 3, 3.5, you know, something like this, and took that as, wow, this guy's a super hawk. Right. What happened? That was, I think, September, right around the end of September 2018. Immediately, the stock market went down 20% from, you know, September 30th till Christmas Eve. It was almost like straight down. Mm-hmm. And then what happened? We got the Powell pivot. He goes, never mind. Don't worry about it. We're going to, we don't need to raise rates anymore. We're going to be on hold. Right. Mm-hmm. So this whole idea of, We're well away from neutral, just went out the window. Then in 2019, we had problems in the money markets, and they immediately had to go back to expanding the balance sheet. So he tried to kind of come in and convince the markets he was hawkish, and it just didn't work. It just fell apart within 12 months. I think we're seeing kind of something similar with Warsh. Obviously, it's a different situation. Obviously, I think he's trying to be even more hawkish, but it's a different situation because inflation is a bigger problem, obviously, than it was in 2018. The Fed has missed its mark for over 5 years now. On the inflation side, and right, we've printed many trillions of dollars in the interim. So the Fed's balance sheet is far bigger than it was. The federal debt to GDP is far bigger than it was. It makes it much more difficult. It could be a much bigger challenge for Warsh to be hawkish than it was for Powell. So I think he's trying to come in and walk back some of the extreme dovish policies that we've seen really since the great financial crisis, right? he's concerned with the balance sheet, right? We've taken the balance sheet, you know, way too far. That's one of the things he talks about. This communication, right? People who remember Greenspan, like he said nothing. There were no press conferences. The statements were nothing. People literally looked at his briefcase, the size of his briefcase, to try and get an idea of what the Fed was going to do. You know, like, because they didn't communicate anything. So he's trying to walk back some of this hand-holding, right? There's been a lot of hand-holding with markets based on forward guidance. That forward guidance was created, you know, by Ben Bernanke to say, we're going to lower interest rates to zero. How do we get even more dovish than that? Well, we tell markets we're going to be at zero for the next 3 years, right? We're going to, you know, it's not just zero today. It's going to be zero. So how do you get even more dovish than 0% interest rates? That's where forward guidance came from. So you understand, okay, we don't have 0% interest rates anymore. We don't need to hold the market's hand anymore. We can walk back some of these dovish policies. But I think you're absolutely right to point out markets have become accustomed to these things. There's not a lot of risk premium built into the equity market. There is more risk premium built into the treasury market, but that's only relative to the last 5 years. If you look at like the risk premium in the treasury based on like 30 years, it's right where it kind of should be. So, you know, what he's trying to do should raise risk premiums across a number of asset classes, because that's the Fed saying, we're not going to hold your hand anymore. We need you to figure this out on your own. So premiums in treasury market, premiums in the equity market should rise. Whether he can actually continue this maintain this in original intent, if the markets have a freak out, you know, a taper tantrum. I guess that was another example. Bernanke tried to taper and we had the taper tantrum. And as soon as the markets freaked out, Bernanke said, okay, never mind. Don't worry about it. Right. So there's a lot of pressure on the Fed chair to, you know, when they're trying to walk back these policies and impose a little bit of, I call it tough love on the markets, you know, that you get a tantrum and you got to withstand that tantrum. I don't know if he can withstand that tantrum just because, of the size of the, you know, the economy is so dependent on the financial markets now, in the stock market. The stock market goes down, the top of the K, the wealth effect starts to go away, and that could be really damaging to the economy. And if you raise interest rates at a time when, you know, we're already spending $1 trillion a year on interest costs on the current levels of debt, and you're going to raise that by, you know, orders of magnitude, put a lot of pressure on the federal government. So there's just, it's the stakes are so much higher for Warsh today. It's going to be, I think, difficult for him to try and follow through. Mm-hmm.
Does this era kind of also underscore the necessity and importance of liquidity within the stock markets, considering that we're also at, I think, an all-time high for margin within the stock markets from investors as well?
Yeah. I mean, the leverage embedded in the stock market is something that's very, very concerning to me. I think, you know, Bloomberg put out a piece over the weekend. Wall Street Journal has a piece today on that topic, that it's margin debt is at records, however you want to measure it, nominally inflation adjusted, relative to GDP, do margin debt to GDP, margin debt to M2, relative to the money supply, is one I wrote about recently, because there's only one month in history that's been higher today in terms of margin debt to M2, and that's March of 2000, the peak of the dot-com bubble. So literally, you know, we're at extreme leverage. The thing we didn't have, though, in 2000 was all these leveraged ETFs, right? We have leveraged semiconductor 3X, you know, ETF. You have a leveraged SpaceX single stock ETF. You have, you know, all the money, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars that have literally gone into these leveraged ETFs. And then they're using equity swaps and things, you know, they're using leveraged products to try and keep these products matching the leverage performance they're supposed to manage. And then what's going on, obviously, you know, in the options markets, really, in the last 5-6 years, we see, incredible amount of trading in far out of the money call options. And so the amount of leverage that is underpinning this market is like nothing we've ever seen before. You know, you read a book like The Great Crash 1929, and I'm spacing on the author's name right now, but it'll come to me. But he talks about the level of margin debt in 1929 was possibly one of the greatest sentiments, ways to measure sentiment in the market that you could ever ask for. And so going by that, you'd have to say that it's undeniable that just based on the use of leverage that we are in a speculative mania that's really rare, unlike almost anything we've ever seen before in the U.S. stock market. So yes, this is what Warsh is dealing with. You want to raise interest rates and potentially prick the asset bubble. The prospect of this leverage unwinding, you know, NASDAQ went down 90% when the dot-com bubble burst. And the fact that we have far more leverage today than we did then should be, you know, frightening to somebody in his shoes.
Mm-hmm. Was it John Kenneth Galbraith?
Yes, Galbraith. Good. Of course. Thank you.
Hey, I can look the odd thing up while you're speaking. But, you know, Jesse, you wrote about in one of your recent reports here, or your kind of weekend review piece, that the importance for a lot of the Mag 7 companies that have seen so much outperformance over, let's say, the last decade, you know, the idea that each of them enjoyed basically a monopoly in each of their fields, whether it was, you know, deliveries in Amazon service, or in Amazon's case, or in Microsoft with basically software, there's almost a monopoly. And now you have companies, these AI companies, that are all kind of competing for the same piece of pie. And they're not exactly the price setter that any of the Mag 7 was, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a terrific point. This is a point that Jeremy Grantham has been making recently. And it's such an important point that, for the last 10 years, I mean, at least 10 years, you've seen, you know, Amazon has its, its own thing in retail. And then really what, you know, made it a super stock was the, you know, cloud business, right? They basically invented the cloud business and had almost no competition there for, mm-hmm. for years. You got Meta in social media. You got Google, Alphabet in, you know, Google search, YouTube. They all kind of have their, and Microsoft in, you know, software. And so they all kind of had their own sandboxes and they didn't kind of cross over into each other's businesses. And because they owned these properties that had such terrific moats, as Warren Buffett would call them, that, you know, there was no competition. They could basically charge whatever they wanted. And as a result of that, I mean, a lot of people have talked about the great enshittification, right, of these products. And it's exactly what's happened, right? I mean, you look at Google search and it almost became, it's so like overrun with ads that it's like ridiculous, unusable. Mm-hmm. But you could say that about all of these, products individually. Meta, Instagram. I mean, my wife and I were talking about Instagram, and my brother-in-law is a professional photographer, and he turned us on to it like in the early days. And it was just mm-hmm. like, this is a fun way to put filters on your photos and share it with your friends, you know? And then it turned into this like, you know, crazy algorithm based, you know, influencer thing. And it's totally, totally different now. Totally, in my opinion, you know, and shittified.
That's nearly 50% ads as well.
Right. Yeah. It's just, it's unusable mm-hmm. in my opinion. But what allowed them to do that and squeeze so much profit out of these things and shove so many ads into Google search was like literally had no competition, right? Mm-hmm. Now, right, I think Google got totally frightened. Microsoft saying, we're going to use OpenAI to create a better, you know, search product in Bing. And all of a sudden, now you can get these, you know, just search with a chatbot and you don't, it's like a way better experience, right? I use Perplexity and I never go to Google. I never use Google, You know, I there's other search engines that I'll use that have less ads, but you know, most of the time you can ask something like Perplexity and kind of, it'll lead you to sources, you know, without all the enshittified stuff to go with it. You know, in the cloud business, right, all of these companies have gotten into it, right? It's Amazon started it, and then, you know, Microsoft wanted to do it for OpenAI, and Alphabet's doing it now. And so they're all competing now in the same areas, and nobody's demonstrated any ability to generate a profit on large language models, right, for one, or on, you know, the selling of compute through the cloud stuff either, right? The only way these companies are making money through these deals, Microsoft, for example, is we're going to give OpenAI $10 billion. They're going to turn around and give it right back to us. you know, let's call it, we're paying for compute. Mm-hmm. Well, Microsoft, you just gave yourself $10 billion and get to record it as revenue. Good for you, right? It makes your numbers look awesome, but your cash flow looks terrible, right? Because that money, you know, it was really, you know, came off your own balance sheet. So that's what we're seeing. If you look at the free cash flows of these companies, they've all gone to zero. And that is what markets are starting to reckon with. It's why Microsoft has had the worst first half to this year since 2000. Since 2000. It's the worst month the stock has had since 2008. Because people are realizing maybe this business isn't so great after all. And if OpenAI cannot continue to raise money by IPOing, you know, and whatever, where are they going to get the money to meet this $500 trillion of data center commitments that they've made, mm-hmm. right? They're losing tens of billions of dollars every year and then made these $500 trillion in payment commitments. Where's that money going to come from? Originally, it came from VCs. Now, then it's come from big tech doing this circular financing. NVIDIA saying, we're going to give CoreWeave this much money, and then we're going to promise to buy all the compute from CoreWeave that they can't sell. You know, like it's just ridiculous. These companies now have to IPO. The public markets are really the only avenue available to them, Anthropic and OpenAI, to maintain this kind of game of raising more money in order to pay for all the spend that they are intending to do. With OpenAI delaying its IPO, it kind of puts a big question mark on whether this game's going to be able to continue. So, yeah, I think that markets are just starting to kind of reconcile with the fact that the profitability of cloud compute for these hyperscalers might not be there. This could be very, you know, in my opinion, very likely is another massive overbuild, just like the dot-com bubble, just like the railroad mania, where you build way more than is needed. And it comes back to the capital cycle, like we talked about with energy, right? Where's all the money going? It's all going into this area. Necessarily, the returns are going to be terrible going forward, because whenever all the money goes that, you know, someplace, it ends up in a massive oversupply. And that's exactly what's happening, you know, with AI right now. So I think the returns are going to be really bad on a lot of this investing in compute, and markets are just starting to price that.
Well, I think it's really interesting to consider, as you said, the profitability and or their ability to generate revenue. And then you have something like this new Chinese model that just came out. I believe it was over the last week here, that's something like 9 times cheaper to do basically the same job. And in certain cases, like coding, is actually better than all of the other models. So when you have something come out that is 9 times cheaper, and you're a corporation that's been spending $100,000+ per month or per quarter on tokens for this compute, all of a sudden that's going to come under major scrutiny. And I think, you know, obviously the counterpoint to that is how many people are going to be trusting a Chinese AI model from a security standpoint. However, you know, from just a dollars and cents perspective on the average corporation in America, that's going to come under heavy scrutiny, right?
Yeah. Well, it's a great point, right? For the hyperscalers to really be profitable means these LLM companies, developers, these frontier model companies have to be profitable themselves in order to have the money to pay for the compute. Mm-hmm. So the fact that OpenAI and Anthropic are running into this issue where they have to raise prices to try and, you know, because, right, you know, their business model so far is, yeah, sure, we lose money on every token, but we'll make it up in volume, right? the more of a tokens you use, the more money we lose. It's essentially been their business model up to now.
Yeah.
The markets are saying, okay, you can't do this anymore, right? You have to start raising prices and you can't lose money on every token. And so, okay, we raise prices. Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. We're finding that these open source models, many of them Chinese, offer almost performance that is almost on par, and in some places completely on par with that of the top frontier models, the top OpenAI and Anthropic models, at a tiny, tiny fraction of the cost. I think there was one Wall Street strategist who wrote last week that. He talked to companies that are literally saying that the cost of the model that they're using to replace Anthropic is 1.5% of the cost of tokens they're spending on Anthropic. So a 98.5% discount to go use these other open source models. I think Coinbase's CEO came out last week and said they've completely switched to Chinese open source models. They're using even more tokens than they were over the last couple of months, but their spending has dropped 50%, spending half the money on more tokens. Mm-hmm. So, this is the issue that's facing a lot of these companies. I think, that's a very, very clear issue for Anthropic and OpenAI. And I think it's one of the reasons why it's going to be difficult for both of them to come public, because demand for their products, they're trying to raise prices and demand is dropping off of a cliff. That's a big problem. So yeah, I would say the other point that I would make is that right now, I still think 70%-ish of all the spend on compute is on training these frontier models, right? It's training the super high-end Anthropic models, training the super high-end OpenAI model, and only 30% of compute right now is for inference, is actually using the models, right? So if these companies come to the conclusion that, it doesn't make sense to spend hundreds of billions of dollars training the next version of Anthropic's model, OpenAI's model, ChatGPT 6, 7, whatever, that's 70% of the spend on compute that would go away if they just decide, this scaling of, putting more GPUs to work in training a bigger and bigger models is an untenable business model. Then you see, the demand for compute could collapse really quickly. So, I think that's something that markets haven't begun to wrestle with. But I think that's what's on the horizon, is the majority of demand for compute is for training. And if that training starts to decline for any reason whatsoever, the overall demand for compute could crash, really.
It's an incredible puzzle to consider all of the angles of. And I think it underscores the importance of needing that moat for any of these companies to be able to continue the crazy valuations that they've garnered, right? So does this necessarily set us up for this AI bubble crash, Jesse?
Yeah, I think we're already starting to burst. Bubble's already starting to burst. The Mag7 relative performance to the S&P has just been collapsed. You see the dispersion in the market is something that it's literally, we talk about the leverage. The dispersion under the surface is really it's the type of thing you only see at top of a blow off, like in 2000. So dispersion, what am I talking about? Well, I'm talking about even as Micron, SanDisk, Western Digital, these companies set new record highs in a lot of the semi space. There are a lot of stocks hitting new 52-week lows. I mean, this is, should be obvious to a lot of people who are looking at markets, right? We see a lot of these software names have performed, you know, terribly. But that dispersion is usually a sign that the market is really unhealthy. The overall uptrend is too highly dependent on a handful of stocks. If those stocks reverse, the bull market is over. Mm-hmm. And so we were just talking about what would make these stocks roll over, the semiconductor names. Well, it would be if the demand for compute starts to decline as a whole, based on, you know, companies saying, okay, training frontier models is just not a good business model. We don't need to scale anymore. We need small language models. We need other types of things that are going to be the next stage of AI. Then the demand for semiconductors would collapse. At the same time, you see all these, I mean, they just announced today, these memory stocks, memory companies, South Korean companies are investing $500 billion in bringing on new memory on supply in the next few years in South Korea. So we're going to bring on $500 billion of new supply at the same time demand, you know, starting to potentially is the opposite of the energy setup, right? You have heavily inflated demand, right, from token maxing and whatever, because it's been subsidized by by terrible business models. And so demand is overinflated. At the same time, we're going to bring on incredible amounts of supply of chips in the next couple of years. So it's the, you know, where we are in the capital cycles, the absolute worst point to be an investor in semis in these things. And if the semis do start to, you know, top out and reverse because of this, the divergences under the surface of the market, and because the market and the economy has become so heavily dependent on the AI boom, on the build out, on all of these things, that a reversal in that trade has major implications for the broad stock market.
And it's really interesting, as you mentioned, these South Korean basically memory companies, to see the performance over the last month or so of the South Korean stock index.
Yeah. And if you want to see what like a 1920s style mania, 90s in Japan, look at what's gone in Korea and Taiwan, over the last year. You have retail investors buying leveraged products like never before. I think Bloomberg has done some really interesting work on kind of digging down street level, how many people, just ordinary people, are buying leveraged products on, SK Hynix and, you know, these types of things. And it's just a dangerous situation. But it's very clearly a speculative mania that, is, like I said, it looks to be in the process of topping out, reversing. Mm-hmm.
So Jesse, at this time, what gives you the ability, let's say, the ability to sleep at night, the ability to not panic when we're faced with turnarounds in major asset prices? Where do you see either opportunity or an ability to create yourself this, feeling of safety in order to be able to remain calm through pullbacks like this that we've seen?
I think there's a variety of ways you can do it. I think that, diversification is something that I talk about consistently. You know, I think a lot of people, you know, interpret my bearishness as saying, you know, go out and short the broad stock market. That's not what I'm saying. I think the vast majority of people shouldn't even ever consider that. Stan Druckenmiller, who's the greatest hedge fund manager of all time, you know, and successful at shorting, said he doesn't know if he's ever made in total any money at all on the short side. So if that's the greatest trader of all time saying, you know, it's really hard for him, the rest of us should say, okay. So just, I guess, you know, my point for most people is be diversified, right? Mm-hmm. Don't just own U.S. stocks. Don't just own, you know, we've had this I guess, bear market in diversification for 10, 15 years now, where it's been, okay, I don't want to own, foreign stocks. I want to own just U.S. stocks. Okay, I don't want to own just U.S. stocks. I want to just own just tech. Okay, I don't want to own just tech. I want to just own semis. Okay, I want to own just memory. And, you know, it's like, and I want to, now I just want to own 3x levered memory. You know, it's like, it's just narrowed to this crazy, crazy level. And it's like, I think we're looking at a bull market in diversification that's going to last for a long time, where people are going to start to see the benefits again of, okay, no, I don't want to just own memory. I don't want to just own tech. I need to own some energy in the portfolio, right? Energies, if you own S&P 500, you don't own energy. It's 2% mm-hmm. of your allocation or something, you know? So it could easily be 5-10% of an allocation just to kind of diversify the index some. But I also want to own other asset classes. I mean, this is a point I've been making for 10 years now. It makes a lot of sense to have an allocation to real assets, to things like commodities, commodity producers, tips, precious metals. And so I think when you have a broad asset allocation that's broadly diversified, there's really not one thing in there that should keep you up at night, because it's evenly balanced by some of these other things. Mm-hmm. And if you kind of take a tactical approach to that and say, okay, I want to use things that are cheap and out of favor, that maybe have a really good kind of fundamental story as my method of diversifying, like add some energy, add some precious metals and things, it's going to be, I think that's, to me, what helps me sleep at night. Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Well, Jesse, it's always a pleasure to kind of walk through all these things with you. Of course, all of your stuff is available at thefelderreport.com, F-E-L-D-E-R report.com, where you have one free weekly offering. It's just kind of an overview of interesting stories that you've come across during the week. And of course, you have some more in-depth offerings there too, right?
Yeah, I write up like a premium report that features a weekly market comment that's much more in depth than the weekend piece. It's a lot of these things that kind of we talked about today that I write about in depth. And then I have a pro product too, where I actually write up individual trade ideas, kind of single stock things where I'm seeing interesting insider activity and that sort of thing.
Excellent. Jesse, thanks so much for your time today. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, always fun to talk to you, Tom. Thanks.